In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Well, we were expecting an October surprise of some sort. Usually it's some underhanded trick, some scandal at the last minute that the Democrats hope will derail Republicans. We did get one, but it was the day after October. And this time, it's one that blew up in the Democrats' face. The monthly job report numbers always come out on the first Friday of the month. In a fortunate quirk, it just so happens November 1st was the first Friday. Otherwise, the absolutely dismal jobs report would not have come out until the Friday after the election, 3 days later. Because no matter how anyone in the propaganda media tries to spin it, this was an absolutely dismal and shocking number. 12,000. Only 12,000 jobs created in October. When I first saw that, I thought it was a typo that they'd left out a zero. Keep in mind, going into the jobs report release, Wall Street had been predicting a rather meager 100,000 jobs. The average jobs report number is usually in the ballpark of 200,000. So the estimate going in was half the normal expectation, but then they only barely got 10% of that. Of course, iSpy Radio listeners all know that the Biden administration has consistently overestimated the number of jobs created every month. Just a few months ago, they were finally forced to erase 818,000 jobs that never actually existed, even though they claimed they had. Not only was October's 12,000 jobs pathetic, but on Friday they also erased 112,000 jobs that had never existed from September and August combined. Even before the jobs number, earlier in the week, there was a pathetic GDP number coming in at only 2.8%. A normal GDP is considered 3%. Things are just not looking good for Kamalanomics. The economy is the number one issue for the vast majority of voters. Last week, we looked at one segment of the economy, energy, and how a Trump administration will drive down the costs that Biden and Kamala have driven up. This week, we're looking at the broader economy, especially comparing the two administrations and what we can expect. You can expect more of the same with Kamala, who said that she can't think of a single thing that she would change from what Biden was doing if she had been president. To me, the key difference between Trump and Kamala is this. When Trump was in office, his focus was to grow the economy and jobs, and he did a tremendous job of that, and he has signaled that he will cut government to grow the economy and even more jobs. For Biden and Kamala, their focus has been to grow the government and transfer wealth from the taxpayers to their side of the political aisle. And they did a tremendous job of that. More than $2 trillion has gone to far-left causes and organizations, borrowed by you, the U.S. taxpayer. You'll be paying interest on that $2 trillion for years and even decades. And Kamala has definitely signaled she will do more of that if she gets elected. So which do you want? To talk about all of that, I'd like to welcome Jonathan Williams back to the show. He is the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist for the American Legislative Exchange Council, as well as the co-author of Rich States, Poor States. Jonathan, it's great to talk to you again.
Well, great to talk to you as always, my friend.
Yeah, so it's Halloween weekend, and so lots of spooky things out there that we're going to get into some of these. But I'd like to actually start our discussion with sort of a look back at the two records on the economy with the election coming up the way that it is. And we'll just sort of compare and contrast these. Let's start with Trump. He was handed a sluggish Obama economy, which he was able to turn around before COVID hit. And even after COVID hit, he was able to correct a lot of the problems that blew up there. Is all of that correct? And were things demonstrably better under Trump in terms of the overall economy?
Well, you know, you set a good context there in that, you know, we were coming out of some weak economic times, really some slow growth periods of time where, you know, the discussion broadly in many of those years leading up to the Trump administration in 2017 when they started was this idea of so many American companies leaving America for no other reason than it was high cost and high tax to do business in the United States. And so, you know, one of the biggest things that that President Trump did, along with then that 2-year period where they had a conservative Congress and the House and the Senate, was they said, we need to remake our tax code. And it, as you know well, the history of this, Mark, it goes back 31 years previous to that, the last time that the tax code had been remade, and that was under President Ronald Reagan, way back when Top Gun the First was top at the box office. That's how long ago it was. And it took all the time until Tom Cruise brought Top Gun back again, basically to get tax reform done and get at the federal level. And the reason, of course, was that there was that slow period of growth. You had this issue of inversions, these American companies that were becoming foreign companies. And we were really shooting ourselves in the foot, economically speaking, leading up to that period. And what, of course, President Trump did with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, Kevin Brady from Texas chaired that from Ways and Means. He was kind enough to invite me to testify and provide comments to the first hearing that they did on that tax reform. And it really changed the face of America when it comes to competitiveness. And it became, America became competitive again. We had the highest business taxes among all of our major competitors across the world leading up to that. And now we got back at least to average. And I think it's safe to say when at least we don't have to compete with one hand tied behind our back, I have full confidence in the American men and women and businesses across the United States that we're going to outcompete all of our competitors if at least we can get those barriers out of the way. And that was one of the biggest things that I don't think gets enough attention was President Trump remade American tax policy for the first time in 3+ decades. And we're still seeing dividends from that because of those companies coming back, brought trillions of dollars of wealth back to the United States to work for us, to create jobs here. And that's something that is a huge topic right now, that if nothing is done in Washington by the end of 2025, all of those tax cuts for individuals go away. That's something that Kamala Harris has pledged to do on day one. Now, it's not really within the president's power to do that away with those in unilaterally on day one, but that's, of course, what she has pledged. And, of course, then you have President Trump looking to remake those and make those tax cuts permanent.
Yeah. Well, that is scary. And I love the fact that Trump was bringing those companies back. As far as the Biden-Harris administration, when they took over, we were already on our way to recovery from COVID. We were coming out of that. But then we ran into massive inflation. We had all sorts of problems with supply chains, and it just seemed like everywhere you looked, the economy was just falling apart. I don't believe that the overall economy has been anywhere near as good under Kamala as it was under Trump. Do you also believe that? And what are some of the elements that you can point to that demonstrate that things were, in fact, better under Trump?
Well, you know, it's when you look at the totality of the records, I think it's important because there's a lot of noise that goes on a monthly or quarterly basis when we see these government reports come in. And we've talked often on your show about just kind of some of the inherent errors with government GDP reports or with jobs reports and some of the downward revisions that happen with those. But I think if you look at kind of the overall records, and no doubt the most recent numbers are not bad, when it looks to the economy right now, my friend Gary Palmer, who's in the U.S. House now representing Alabama in Congress, a longtime friend of Alec, he did a really interesting comparison just earlier today talking about these records where, for instance, under this current administration, we saw inflation rise 2.5 times faster, so nearly 20%. Inflation, when you look and add it all up during the last 2-3.5 years here, than under the Trump administration, where they had less than 8% total inflation, where rising costs like essentials on housing, food, and fuel, especially straining household budgets in recent years. So certainly the inflation piece of it is big. That, of course, one of the pieces of that is housing and lack of affordable housing, where median-priced homes, for instance, that affordability has deteriorated significantly in the last several years.
Yes.
And so that's a huge difference, I think, what we've seen more recently under the Biden-Harris administration. And then the other one that is a little bit less in the headline news, Mark, but I think it's one that's really important, is what we've seen in terms of households, a massive new cost of regulation over the last 3.5 years, a huge focus of the Trump administration, and one that they did not get nearly enough credit for, was their deregulatory agenda by removing those red tape barriers to job creation and for individuals and things that really add up in terms of cost of housing and other products leading to this inflation. You actually saw a reduction of cost of regulation during the Trump administration, where you've seen tens of thousands of dollars per household in new regulatory costs added in the last 3.5 years. So I think for me, those are three of the big, most stark points pointed out by my friend Congressman Palmer.
Yeah, and the quicksand that has created for so many people as they try to get out of this economic mess that Biden-Harris administration has created. Okay, let's go take a break. Lots more to talk about with Jonathan Williams coming up. We're going to talk about some of the misuse and abuse of the economy. Stay with us.
Get a little more intelligence on big government. You're listening to the iSpy Radio Show.
We always like to check in with Jonathan Williams at least once a quarter, but with the election closing in and the economy often the deciding factor for most voters, we thought this final weekend would be a great time to have him on to get some in-depth look at what is happening or not happening in the economy. Jonathan is the Executive Vice President of Policy and Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. You can visit them at alec.org. That's A-L-E-C.org. And Jonathan, we were talking about the economy in the wake of the Biden administration taking over, and they made a lot of mistakes, I think, that probably amplified some of the problems that we saw with COVID, and things just never really seemed to get better. But one of the things that I'd like to talk about in this segment is the tools that an administration has for good or bad when it comes to tinkering with the economy. And so what are some of the tools administrations of whichever stripe, whichever party, can be misused or abused? And I assume agency regulations are right up there at the top.
Well, that's right. Agency regulations is a huge one. It's something I just alluding to there with just the massive new burden of regulation that's been placed on the average American household, nearly $50,000 when you put a price tag on it, just shocking numbers.
Yeah.
Even to those of us who follow this in this last administration, a new regulatory cost being added where you had Trump, when he was president, really focused on a deregulatory agenda to remove barriers. And oftentimes those fly under the radar, but they're just as important as other costs like taxes and trade costs and things like that to be successful at business or to keep costs low for things like housing, which is a huge piece out there. So regulatory, I think, is going to be really important. And I think that when you look at this new reality post-Supreme Court decision in the Loper-Bright case, right? And this year, when it comes to the Chevron deference,
right,
and looking at ways that we can actually have a more holistic approach of regulatory review and making sure that we can have a robust look at what that looks like going forward. I mean, I think that's a huge element. It's flying under the radar, unfortunately. So much attention is being looked at the politics right now, but there's some real regulatory reform opportunities, I think, for a next administration, whoever that may be. Let's hope that they're deregulatory instead of pro-regulatory.
Yes. Yeah, I don't see that happening with Kamala, but you never know. She may suffer a serious head injury and totally change her view on things, but you just never know. I'd mentioned this about misuse and abuse of the government, and one of the things that I'm looking at here is how these agencies can be used to go after their political opponents. And I'm not just talking about Department of Justice going after Trump. I'm thinking of Elon Musk, who seems to be public enemy number two behind President Trump. He's been fascinating to follow on X, formerly Twitter. And he's mentioned how some of his companies have come under fire through this misuse and abuse of the regulatory environment after he bought Twitter and decided to turn it into a free speech zone and refused to censor people. One of the things that he mentioned was that his rocket company, SpaceX, was forced in order to get some kind of permit. I think it was like a landing area or something along the coast. And one of the things that they were forced to do was to kidnap baby seals to do a study. And they had to make them wear headphones and pump loud noises at them. And then study the effects and report back. I mean, it just sounds so incredibly inhumane. There's our government doing this kind of stuff.
Well, it's really just shocking. I mean, when I first saw that, I thought this might be a Babylon Bee or an Onion headline. Yeah. I mean, it's just shocking that that's legitimate news and what these agencies have been forcing on companies. I mean, it kind of goes to prove the underlying point that we've made for years, which is, the key principle of limited government, which is, a government big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take away everything you have.
Yes.
It's a line that's always stuck with me, right? And so when government is too big, we put too much power in whether it's elected branch or even worse, unelected agencies in many cases, or the bureaucratic branch. This is, of course, get back to the issue of the Chevron deference and unelected bureaucrats running the show in many cases. That needs to be addressed. And, especially when you have a political element of this, where you have the weaponization of government or you have lawfare, as we're seeing continued, whether it's DOJ and the Trump administration, whether it's certainly we've seen the abuses in the IRS administrations of both parties going way back on that.
Yeah.
That is something that should send chills down the spine of every freedom-loving American. It's something that we absolutely, I think, need to put better guardrails on to protect innocent Americans and give them at least due process to defend themselves from these type of things. Because when you have the situation like California with Elon Musk, and you have these even regional or local zoning agencies or other things like that having a political axe to grind, mm-hmm. The opposite, obviously, of good, well-functioning government.
Yes. Well, human beings are prone to giving into all sorts of vindictive behaviors. And unfortunately, a lot of them end up in government. And so when they are able to unleash that on people, it's horrifying. And, another one of his companies, Starlink, and this is a company that uses satellites to provide wireless internet connection in rural areas so you don't have to string all of these lines and stuff. Their contract was rescinded. They had won this from the government to go out there and provide internet to these rural areas. But once he bought Twitter, they pulled that contract, and the government decided they were going to spend, I want to say it was $24 billion to go out and provide rural internet, but it was way more expensive than what Musk was had to offer. But none of it was ever done. They spent $24 billion and nothing was ever done. You look at that, and I'm sure there, he's just one example. I'm sure there are dozens and hundreds and thousands of companies facing that kind of abuse by government bureaucrats. I just think of all of the innovation that could be happening if government just got out of the flipping way.
Well, this one's especially problematic, right, in that, here you have a company who just, I think, recently announced is providing, free coverage for those impacted by mm-hmm. the devastating floods and the hurricanes and, North Carolina and places around the southeastern United States. You have a company using that kind of technology and innovation for good, and they're the ones that are deemed as somehow the bad guys and being attacked by regulators.
Yeah.
And there's something completely foul about that scenario, and it's something that, look at how many billions of dollars Congress appropriated and sent out supposedly to solve many of these rural broadband issues. Not a dollar has been spent because of too much regulation, and here we have this innovative technology that could solve that issue for a fraction of the cost.
Yes.
And people would rather play politics and letting innovators like Elon Musk do what they need to do to provide these key services.
Yeah, well, and to deny that kind of service to people in those rural areas, it really shows that some of these people that are in charge just hate Americans. That's what it comes down to, unfortunately. All right, it is Halloween weekend, and there are some spooky economic ideas out there. We'll talk about that next with Jonathan Williams of Alex. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking to Jonathan Williams. He is the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist of the American Legislative Exchange Council. And we've been really comparing and contrasting the two different economies under Trump and Kamala and what those things might look like. And Jonathan, leading up to the show here, when we were arranging our interview, you had mentioned to my producer, Carla, that there are lots of spooky ideas out there on things like taxes and spending and debt. And we already know that Kamala has floated the idea of taxing unrealized gains, and this is money that you haven't even earned yet, but might in the future, and somehow they're going to tax that. Is that one of the spooky ideas on taxes that you had in mind?
Well, it certainly is spooky, and we'll see how realistic it would be. It's a terrifying idea, and it's a whole new frontier of tax policy, really opening up the really a can of worms when it comes to the definition of what income could be like, right? And this would be more of a wealth tax and income tax. There's a lot of, I think, real constitutional concerns around it. I do think it's unlikely to end up passing, because even you have some of Kamala Harris's largest supporters and people like Mark Cuban out there saying it's a bad idea when it comes to tax policy. And so I think it probably wouldn't fly on Capitol Hill. However, just the idea of being proposed, and maybe it's a pandering to the far left progressive base out there, but a horrible idea on tax policy. Of course, there's many more where that comes from, but that certainly takes the cake for one of the newest ideas of a bad way to go about taxing.
Oh, absolutely. And it's just from a mental sense there, you can see the impact that it would have on wealth creation. If you make money, we will punish you. And that's money that you haven't even earned yet. It's just money that you might earn. I did see on social media that people were saying, well, this could impact homeowners, that if your house value goes up, you could be taxed on that. But others were saying that, you know, they're out there defending Kamala, pointed out that the unrealized gains tax only applies to the super wealthy. And I think that's correct. It would not apply to the average homeowner. So what's the reality there?
Well, the reality is the proposal may say one thing, but I think as we've learned from hundreds of years of looking at tax policy in the United States, it's a very much a camel's nose under the tent scenario.
Yeah, exactly.
Where you had, let's say, the personal income tax wasn't even allowed in the United States until the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. Mm-hmm. A lot of people forget the founders, I think, wisely thought that an income tax would be the end of privacy in the United States, as well as a undue burden on taxpayers. So they disallowed it in the Constitution. It took that progressive era of Woodrow Wilson and the progressives to put that in the Constitution. And where did it start? It started, at least in theory, as a tax on the super wealthy at a very low rate. And they were able to set that in place. And then over time, you have different spending desires of politicians in Congress. And, added 100 years to that formula, and we end up to where we are today, where government is taking far too much through the income tax regime. And I think you could see a plausible path, even though it may seem uncertain right now in terms of the politics of it. But if you were to able to start a new tax at a very low rate, promising it's only going to affect the millionaires and billionaires, how long does that last? In an era, you know, marked now of 35 plus trillion of national debt, I think that rate gets ratcheted up pretty quickly if they're successful at implementing something.
Yeah. Well, you also mentioned spooky ideas on spending, and I'm almost afraid to hear this.
Well, it's not going to surprise anybody. I encourage everybody to go to the National Debt Clock. Spend a few minutes at the National Debt Clock. See what your portion of the national debt is, your family's portion, maybe your unborn child's portion or your grandchild's portion of what that's going to be. You know, it is a terrifying number that's growing at a trajectory and a frequency that is almost unfathomable, where you see hundreds of billions of dollars added in chunks of time. And now at a point where we're at nearly $36 trillion in national debt, you have to ask the question of how do you even begin to chip away at this? Obviously, the first step of getting out of a hole is stop digging it deeper. And that's going to be something that's going to require a whole lot of commitment from either a Harris or a Trump administration, because to be honest, we've got parties of all stripes that have failed on the spending side of the equation. We need a reset. And I think the idea of putting an innovator like Elon Musk in charge of an idea of the how do you get government spending in check, how do you look at ways to find efficiency, we've seen that work really effectively at the state level, where legislators roll up their sleeves and start to analyze government agencies and programs, you know, looking at maybe some low-hanging fruit like the Department of Education, which has not educated children and has educated a lot of bureaucrats and paid a lot of bureaucrats' salaries. But let's put that money to really work for families and children across the United States for educational outcomes, for instance. And looking at things like that, somebody like an Elon Musk or others like him, I think are incredibly important for those big picture conversations that need to happen.
Well, spooking spending ideas, when you mention that, I'm thinking Kamala getting in and just imagining a completely bottomless checkbook, which is pretty horrifying. You had also mentioned spooky ideas on debt. Was there anything in particular? I mean, you mentioned the debt clock and all that. Was there anything else in particular about that you wanted to mention?
Well, I think it's that's the biggest piece is just the growth of where we're at right now and that trajectory that continues almost on autopilot now, right? I mean, there's so much of the budget. You talk to any of the folks on Capitol Hill, there's so much of the budget that's on autopilot that's not even considered, that is just continuing to grow. And that's, by the way, as you know well, the $35 trillion in debt doesn't even consider Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid,
right,
which that number is about $100 trillion. And it becomes a real problem of just being able to get people's minds and even anyone's mind wrapped around that massive number. What does that actually mean? A trillion's a lot of money. What's 10 trillion? What's 100 trillion? It's the magnitude problem that I think people's eyes glaze over, but that problem is becoming exponentially worse over time.
Yeah, absolutely. This next question will take a little bit, but Halloween weekend is right before the election here. Ghosts and goblins and no end of scaremongering by the left-stream media to scare people away from Trump, who is apparently Hitler come back from the grave, but one of his ideas has truly terrified the media and the Democrats and the big government, big spenders, no income tax. So we'll talk about that next with Jonathan Williams. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's the final weekend before the election, and we're talking with Jonathan Williams. He is the Vice President of Policy and Chief Economist of the American Legislative Exchange Council. You can visit them at alec.org. That's ALEC.org. And we'll link that up on today's show page, which is 14-44 on iSpy Radio. And Jonathan, before we get into the whole no income tax at all, which has certainly scared a lot of people, we were talking about spooky ideas. And one of the things that has just been crazy, and we talked about this last week with our guest Frank Lassay, one of the things that California is looking at doing is nationalizing, so to speak, or statitizing anyway, the oil refinery business. And are you hearing this anywhere else that other Democrat-led states are looking at nationalizing elements of their economy and just taking over industries?
Well, I mean, not on that kind of a scale. I mean, that is a horrible idea, right? I mean, if it works so well, then Venezuela would be the place That's that right. everyone's going today for business opportunities and to live. Of course, it doesn't work that way with socialism. It's not surprising that California is potentially the first out of the gate with that kind of a bad idea. Generally, bad ideas start in California and spread elsewhere. But that's still it takes a high bar to surprise with bad ideas. And yet that one really caught me by surprise when I first heard that.
Well, it's pretty crazy that any state would consider doing that. But anyway, I do want to move on to Trump here because he's known for his public brainstorming. He'll float various ideas to see how people react. He's even been known to start talking policy with everyday people that he just runs into, you know, janitors, electricians, and, you know, he just talks to everybody. And that's apparently how he came up with the whole no tax on tips idea. He had been talking to a waitress and she said how they just get killed on their taxes on tips. So let's go through a couple of his ideas here that he's floated out there and get your thoughts on how serious he is, how they would work and whether or not they'd be a good idea. But before we get there, I think it's pretty clear that when it comes to taxes and all of the taxes that Trump wants to get rid of, I think it's pretty clear that Trump has in mind that they're going to have to slash an awful lot of the federal budget. Do you think he's floating these no tax on whatevers because he wants to force the issue that Congress must absolutely cut the budget?
I think that's part of it, right? I mean, you have a really someone who is Mr. Art of the Deal.
Yes.
Whether you look at trade or you look at taxes or other government funding proposals, I think that's something that his negotiation skills were really top notch. Whether you look at some of the foreign policy discussions where he didn't have any major global conflict, there's a lot to be said about that. Potentially, he doesn't get enough credit for that in a lot of cases. And I do think, you know, that his discussions around this government efficiency commission and government spending, obviously key to any ability to cut taxes at all, especially something large like no tax on tips or some of the other ideas floated. See, the spending and taxing are two sides of the same fiscal coin, so they must move together. And whether it's the philosophy of, you know, cut spending so then you can cut taxes, or cut taxes and then make sure that the spending cuts are necessity at that point, the so-called starve the beast formula or strategy in that case. It really can work both ways, but of course they need to be done in tandem at the end of the day to make things balance.
Yeah. Well, in terms of Trump and no tax on tips, what's the likelihood of that, you think? And is that a good idea or not?
Well, I mean, it sounded like it picked up steam with the with Kamala Harris as well. After President Trump had said that, Vice President Harris had picked that up. So it seems like there's bipartisan consensus around the idea at the moment. The question is, of course, is how it would work in practice. And I think that that would be a little bit trickier for tax writers when you're going to sharpen up the pencils and look at writing tax legislation, how to make that happen. Of course, the effect would be, I think, a whole lot more people would be looking to get paid through tips versus wages. And that has, you know, potential for unintended consequences when it comes to tax policy and how people would structure things. That's a little bit of an egghead way to answer the question. I think the broader point, though, is why is it that we charge so much government fare, how much government tax on people's income and tip income especially? I mean, that is a fair question, especially for those that are looking to make ends meet and living paycheck to paycheck. Why does government take so much of what we earn?
Right.
That is the more fundamental question, and I think at the end of the day, that's what President Trump is trying to get at, to say government's chunk of our income and our savings is far too high, and we need to look at ways to begin to chip away at that.
Right, and plus, the idea of a tip is it's a gift. Somebody's provided you excellent service, and so you want to reward them a little bit. So it seems, frankly, as somebody that used to work in a job where I would occasionally get tips, to me, that always seemed unfair that they would tax that. Two of the other ones, no tax on, is no tax on Social Security and no tax on overtime. What's the likelihood of those going through, and are those good ideas or not?
Well, you know, I think this has been a big debate at the state level on Social Security taxes and how states tax retirement income generally, as they look as people vote with their feet across state lines, as we talk about every year in rich states, poor states. Sure. They're looking to attract those at the retirement years as they're looking to potentially relocate after they've been affixed to a location because of a job in some cases. And I think that a lot of the discussion around this issue on Social Security taxes, for instance, is, you know, what is Social Security at the end of the day? Is it something that you've paid into? And if so, you've already paid Social Security FICA taxes. You've paid them on your side. Your employer's paid them on your behalf. A lot of people don't appreciate that fact of it, but there's a whole lot of your total cost of employment that your employer and you share for that benefit of having Social Security upon reaching the age of Social Security or time to retire, right? It's your choice. So that is something that, in some respect, is a fairness question, right? It's that you've already paid taxes on this. Why is government coming taxing something that you paid towards in the first place? It seems to me like a double or a triple tax in that sense. And so I think that's why you've seen so many states begin to rethink how they tax Social Security income, at least at the state level. So it's, I think, a rational conversation to have federally.
Yeah. Well, we have run out of time in this segment. I don't think we can cover Trump and tariffs and no income tax at all in the next 15 seconds, so we will cover that in the next segment. Stay with us. It's the final weekend before the election, and we're talking with Jonathan Williams. He is the Executive Vice President of Policy at ALEC. That's the American Legislative Exchange Council, and he's also their Chief Economist. And he's a co-author of Rich States, Poor States. And Jonathan, I had wanted to talk to you about Trump and his brainstorming ideas here about basically going all tariffs and no income tax at all. This certainly terrified a lot of big government spenders. But I think people forget that for a good chunk of, if not most of, this country's history, we had no income tax. You'd mentioned that earlier there with the whole 16th Amendment. That's what got us around that. And put in the income tax. So, you know, the government was instead funded by sales taxes and tariffs. But we also didn't have massive government spending on endless wars or sending billions of dollars overseas to other countries while people in our own country were suffering and needed help. So what do you think of this idea? Is replacing the income tax with tariffs, is that even possible? Are they still kind of working on that idea? Or do you think the whole thing was just more of a case of Trump brainstorming out loud?
Well, I think it's a valuable discussion for all of us to have as a country because of the history that you point out, that that's essentially how the United States was financed at the federal level pre-16th Amendment in 1913. And it was in many parts of that part of the American experiment were some of the more prosperous in terms of growth in the United States. Now, it was also true at the very same time that government was a tiny fraction of where we're at today in terms of share of the economy, and debt levels were in many cases, much, much lower as well. And so you, I think it does open the broader question, which is, yes, I think it's legitimate to talk about how can we reduce income taxes, how we need to reduce income taxes in the United States, how I think we need to, you know, analyze. Well, look at the states. I mean, the states that do without a personal income tax, we talked about until we're blue in the face, nearly, Texas and Florida and Tennessee and so many of the others that are the biggest growth states in the country are no income tax states versus New York and California and these ideas of states that have big government and high tax proclivities. There's a huge difference in where jobs are being created and where people are moving. And we know this to be the case at the state level, the 50 laboratories of democracy. We know taxes on capital, taxes on income are some of the very most damaging dollar for dollar that you can use as a tax policy. And that all being said, that's a good discussion to have. And how do we reduce our reliance and hopefully work towards eliminating the income tax? How do you get there? I think at the current levels of government spending, it's probably not feasible to go purely with tariffs and other pieces like that, because we also would need to shrink government dramatically. And I think, yeah, that's part of the discussion, though, with you have government restructuring, looking to eliminate agencies in some cases, potentially, or at least look at a major restructuring of government programs. If you do it with the spending discipline and really a remaking of how big the federal bureaucracy has gotten, then it becomes a much more realistic conversation when you get into congressional action on it potentially at some point.
Yeah. Well, I certainly hope that they are serious about that. As you say, it's going to require a massive reduction in spending. But you've got somebody like Elon Musk that Trump has asked to head a government agency on efficiency. There at Twitter, he cut 80% of the workforce. And gosh, it'd be kind of nice to see that happen at the federal level.
Well, exactly. I mean, if we could see a fraction of that type of success at looking at government overspending, even if we were able to keep government spending flat, would be a major victory. But if we could actually go in and cut out major waste, fraud, and abuse and overspending areas, I mean, that's going to be the formula to get us to a place where we can have a real conversation about dramatic cuts to the income tax or ways that we can get off the income tax federally.
Yes. Looking ahead to the future here, because these things are great, but it only happens if we get Trump into office. Your friend and colleague Art Laffer was on Fox the other day, and he said the prices have gone way up under the Biden administration, and there's just simply no sign of them coming down. If Donald Trump gets in with deregulation, with tax cuts, with economic growth on top of that, he expects inflation to come down substantially over the next 4 years if Trump is elected. So are we looking at deflation where prices actually go down, or is it more of a matter of wages going up to absorb the higher costs, or even both, because that'd be awesome?
Well, yeah, let's hope whoever wins that we can get wages up and inflation down. I mean, it's going to be really a big slog to get down levels of pre-pandemic, right, since we've seen such a big run-up in the overall levels of inflation. The discussion in recent months has been, well, inflation is down, and it's at 2% in this period or 1.5% in this period. What's forgotten about is the built-in inflation base that's up dramatically in the last several years because of the run-up in government spending. So I think like that's the first goal, is to chip away at this reduction in our standard of living as a country over what's gone on over the last several years with overspending. And that needs to be goal number one of whoever is in the White House next. And of course, then it certainly helps with the take-home wage piece. But also, on the other hand, we need to grow wages quickly again in the United States by making the United States more competitive, creating more jobs here, and hopefully staving off some sort of a sovereign debt crisis potentially that we're seeing with the debt levels that we're seeing across the world and nations and even the United States. I mean, we are still the world's reserve currency, so less likely to see something like that in the short term, but still very problematic if we don't start to take action.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Well, and, you know, just the mere thought that we could actually reduce spending to the point where we could actually start paying down some of that debt and not simply pay in interest payments on it, I think is pretty exciting. Speaker Johnson was saying that they are going to have a very aggressive first 100-day agenda with a lot of things on the table. And in his words, they want to take a blowtorch to the regulatory state. And he was, I mean, it kind of sounded like they were looking at getting rid of Obamacare and return to free market. Have you heard about that? And are you guys at ALEC involved with that at all?
Well, I'm a big fan of Speaker Johnson. I think he's done a tremendous job to try to bring people together in a very difficult time to be a leader in a legislative chamber at the state level or the federal level, especially given the circumstances when he was able to win the speakership. And so I think that just the overall level that he's governed with principle, you remember when he was selected as speaker, he released his set of conservative principles in which he was going to lead. And I think that's just an incredible trait of good leader. He just celebrated his first year as a speaker just this last week. And I think it's really been a good track record given the very tight Congress that he presides over in the House. And, of course, a Democrat-run Senate and White House.
Yes.
And that being said, I mean, yes, I think that is a realization that 2016, that election, there's a lot of folks that maybe weren't ready to have the majority and have those ideas ready to go. And I think there's been a lot of thinking about that to say, what are the big picture items that free market conservatives, yes, want to attain if voters give them yes, that ability at some point in time? And I think, you know, examining health care is one big, big picture. And I'm glad that Speaker Johnson is focusing on that.
Yes. Well, it certainly sounds like, unlike last time where they're caught kind of flat footed, they are looking like they've got a tremendous number of goals to really take aggressive action in those first 100 days. All right, everyone, stay with us. We will wrap things up with Jonathan Williams. He is the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist at ALEC. That's American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC.org. Back, we're in our final segment now with Jonathan Williams. He is the Executive Vice President of Policy and Chief Economist of the American Legislative Exchange Council. Fantastic organization. You can get your own senator and representative at the state level to join. Just head to alec.org. That's ALEC.org. And you can find links there and how you can suggest that to them. They get great policy tips from ALEC. And so, Jonathan, in the time that we have left, I'd actually like to kind of take a slight break from the economy here that we've been talking about. But if Trump gets elected, it's always one of the things I keep hearing from people is that, well, they're going to try to steal the election. And we have certainly seen tremendous bold-faced efforts of Democrats to try to do that. You've got a case right there going on right now in Virginia.
Well, yeah, there's several, right? And it's really shocking the kind of level of just kind of in your face to the average voter that you would guess this wouldn't even be possible. I mean, the instance in Virginia that we're talking about right now, that Governor Youngkin went about looking to look at depleting the rolls, the voter rolls, pre-election, and making sure that we had, if we had any non-citizens, any non-Americans, citizens of foreign countries, that they would be off the rolls, of course, as non-citizens are not allowed to vote in federal elections. And this was a law that goes back to when Tim Kaine, a member of the Democrat that ran with Hillary Clinton, right, as her nominee, now in the United States Senate, back when he was governor of Virginia, he signed it into law. So this is a bipartisan idea. And yet you had the Biden administration, DOJ, sue Governor Youngkin for this action to try to make sure that the voter rolls were fair and remove non-American citizens from those voter rolls. And so Governor Youngkin, to his credit, didn't take no for an answer on that and fought it in the federal courts. And just as a couple of days ago, saw the U.S. Supreme Court help to intervene to make sure that Governor Youngkin's action was not easily overturned initially by that Biden administration effort from the DOJ. And so while I think there's lots of litigation still to happen on this matter, it's just kind of shocking to the average American to think that you would have the Biden DOJ coming in saying governors shouldn't be able to clean the rolls and remove non-citizens from those rolls. And there was another example back home in Michigan. I just happened to see in the Detroit News where you actually had a Chinese citizen cast a vote.
Before we get to Michigan,
this was a crazy story.
Well, before we get to Michigan, let me just follow up there on the Virginia story. You mentioned how it's crazy that they're trying to keep these people on. It's even more crazy that three of the Supreme Court justices were in favor of keeping them on. It's against the law for them to vote. Why on earth would you want to keep them on? That's pretty insane.
Well, and especially as we're trying to, I mean, on a bipartisan basis, I think it's awfully important that we try to instill more confidence into the idea of fair American elections, right? And this is something to make it easier to vote, harder to cheat.
Exactly.
It's been the mantra at the state level. That's been something that's been so important because in many states, they were not following their own procedures in previous elections, right?
Yeah.
By having these absentee ballots come in, for instance, after election day or without postmark in some cases. So these are all big areas of worry, and it's ought to be something Democrat and Republican alike to say we need to instill more confidence
Absolutely.
In American elections. And if people think that non-American citizens are coming in and voting, in the case of Michigan, they actually did cast a ballot this mm-hmm. week. That is a major problem for that confidence.
Well, and not just that illegal that did that, but then you've got a case where the RNC has uncovered that 164,000 votes were cast illegally. Because it was a group of about 114,000 Michigan citizens that were voting from multiple locations around Michigan. Pretty crazy, but thank goodness the RNC caught that. But then you look back at 2020 and the margin of victory for Biden was, 10, 15,000 votes there in Michigan. And here's 164,000 votes. And if they're trying it now, we can pretty much rest assured that they did, in fact, try that in 2020.
Well, there's a lot of unanswered questions in Michigan in terms of the number of registered voters versus the number of voting age adults, whether you look at this idea of a Chinese citizen casting a ballot and then also no ability to not count that ballot, I'm told at this point, based on the Detroit news story. So the left-wing Secretary of State Benson in Michigan has a whole lot of questions to answer in terms of how Michigan elections are run in a fair and honest way going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've only got about a minute in here with you. You had just had a retreat with your policy team. So can you give us a hint of what some of the more exciting policies are that you guys are working on there at ALEC?
Well, a lot of what we've talked about over the last year or two, and I think we'll expect a lot more where this came from, is energy independence, economic freedom, and education freedom. Those are the areas that we are looking at, once again, just this war on American affordable and reliable energy.
Yes.
As electricity demand goes through the roof with data centers and other things happening in AI and just all the new dynamics there, we need to build more capacity and supply and reduce regulation. We've seen this education freedom revolution where we've seen dollars now following parents and allowing real school choice and freedom options to get kids out of systems that just are not working. Mm-hmm. And of course, economic opportunity. That's exactly what we need is sustained economic growth if we're going to have any shot at getting out of this national debt spiral that we've been talking about here for the last hour. I mean, those are three of the big picture ideas at ALEC.org. We have about 1,000 different pieces of model policy that we're going to be working on with legislators across the country this coming year. So it's always an exciting time at the state level, Mark. Regardless, good or bad news at the federal level, we're going to have a whole lot of good things happening in the 50 laboratories of democracy.
Oh, absolutely. And I love the idea of school choice. Why on earth would anyone want to force parents to keep kids in failing schools is just beyond me. Unfortunately, we are against the clock here. Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, always great to join you, my friend.
Trump is making his closing arguments with daily, if not twice a day or even three times a day events. He is clearly working as absolutely hard as humanly possible to persuade those undecideds. Meanwhile, Kamala already made her closing argument a week out, and her closing argument was the same as her opening argument, everything is Trump's fault, and that includes everything I didn't do that I should have done that I promise I will do. One of these is not like the other. This is your future at stake. This is the future of the country at stake. And that means taking action. Vote. Too big to rig to beat the cheat. Because as we say every week, the best information is you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.